that $150 million would be divided up based on recommendations from the states to NOAA.
Relief funds for last season's king salmon fishery disasters are one step closer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the HAARP project is temporarily shut down.
There are other ionospheric heating facilities to be found in the world, but this one is the best.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Relief funds for last summer's king salmon fisheries disasters on the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers is taking one step closer to reaching fishermen in the region. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes reports.
Funds were included in an early version of the Senate Appropriations Bill. The bill passed out of the Senate's Commerce, Justice, and Science Subcommittee Tuesday. It passed out of the Appropriations Committee today. The bill allocates $150 million for fisheries disasters in Alaska, as well as in New England and Mississippi. Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's uncertain how the money would be split.
That $150 million would be divided up based on recommendations from the states to NOAA, so that is yet to be determined.
The bill requires the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to provide feedback concerning how the funds will be spent. Murkowski says there's still a long road ahead before any checks are written to fishermen. It still has to pass through the full Senate and the House.
So this is the first step in a very important process. It's kind of a brick-by-brick process, but we have moved it yet one step further.
A federal resource disaster was declared last year in September for the Yukon, Kuskokwim, and Cook Inlet Chinook salmon runs after the rivers saw dramatically low numbers. It was the second federal fisheries disaster declared for the Yukon River since 2009. The Alaska delegation, comprised of Murkowski, Senator Mark Begich, and Congressman Don Young, said the process of getting relief funds through Congress could take over a year. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The U.S. Senate has approved two more of President Obama's cabinet picks. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, both Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich voted to move the picks for labor and the EPA along.
Presidential nominations have been the talk of the Senate all week. On Tuesday, leaders averted a rules change that would have allowed senators to confirm a nominee with a simple majority. It takes two votes in the Senate, usually a 60-vote threshold to end debate on the pick, then a majority vote on the confirmation itself. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she has a mantra for presidential picks.
I am not going to block that nominee.
And that's the case with soon-to-be Labor Secretary Tom Perez. Murkowski joined five other Republicans in voting to end debate on Perez. His nomination had been in jeopardy because some Republicans contend he did not cooperate with congressional investigations into his work at the Justice Department. He's been the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights there. While Murkowski voted to end debate, she voted against the final confirmation for Perez and Gina McCarthy for EPA. Senator Mark Begich, who's running for re-election in 2014, voted to move forward with the nomination of McCarthy. She's currently at the EPA, regulating the country's air standards. Her confirmation had been uncertain because of Republican opposition to the president's climate change plans.
No, I had a good meeting with her. We'll have our battles, guaranteed. But I think she understands the importance of oil and gas exploration, and that's where we'll continue to push the envelope to make sure she does not push that the wrong direction.
McCarthy's nomination had been in limbo since March, the longest wait ever for an EPA administrator. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program, or HAARP, facility shut down last month. The official in charge of the military research facility near Glen Allen isn't talking, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the closure appears to be short-term.
Air Force HAARP manager James Keeney would not comment on the facility status, but the University of Alaska Fairbanks has long been involved in research at HAARP. An emeritus professor and former Geophysical Institute director, Roger Smith, says its closure follows expiration of an operations and maintenance contract with the part Inupiat-owned Marsh Creek Corporation.
The Air Force contract with Marsh Creek has come to an end, and a new contract is expected with the UTNA Corporation, and continued operation is expected also.
It's unclear when HAARP will resume operation. Officials with the UTNA Alaska Native Corporation did not respond to requests for comment. The HAARP facility's antenna array is used to stimulate the ionosphere, the electrically charged region of the atmosphere that displays the aurora and transmits communication and navigation signals. Smith says HAARP is very important for research.
It creates a situation where we have essentially an ionospheric laboratory. There are other ionospheric heating facilities to be found in the world, but this one is the best.
HAARP shutdown is hurting work by scientists like Arctic Region Supercomputing Center Research Assistant Professor Chris Fallon. UAS Fallon has a grant through the Air Force's Young Investigator Research Program
to investigate artificial auroras created by HAARP.
Fallon is using HAARP to develop a computer model of the ionosphere.
One of the important things for ionosphere modeling is to be able to compare what the model says is happening in the ionosphere to what's actually happening. And so there's a number of instruments at the HAARP facility and nearby that record things like the magnetic field strength or the critical frequency of the ionosphere.
Fallon says real-time data has not been available since HAARP powered off in June. He's compensating with archive data, but says without HAARP, he can't do any new experiments to verify aspects of his model. HAARP has long been a popular subject for conspiracy theorists who allege its use or impact on everything from weather to the human mind. UAF Smith says there's no research to verify such claims, but acknowledges looming questions about what the military is after with HAARP and offers several ways atmospheric manipulation could be used.
For example, if you can communicate underwater, then one possibility is communication with submarines. If you are dealing with the ability to be able to destabilize radiation particles in the magnetosphere, then there's a possibility of being able to deflect the effects of a nuclear attack.
Smith says HAARP is also being considered to test radar survey of the Arctic. He anticipates the facility returning to service in time for the start of a research campaign scheduled to begin this fall. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, practicing martial arts in rural Alaska.
I see myself improving and getting better. A new, like, way of life, I'd say. A new understanding of a different type of activity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
We're now in the midst of Ramadan, the holiest month of the year for those of the Islamic faith. More than 1.6 billion Muslims across the globe are observing the holiday each night through the middle of August, many with large community celebrations. But for Muslims in Petersburg and across Alaska, they have adapted to celebrating where they can and sometimes alone. KFSK's Robbie Feinberg reports.
It's just before sundown, and Tariq Halu and his wife Anjel McDonald are preparing some Middle Eastern cuisine in their home in Petersburg. McDonald grills some cheese from sheep's milk on the stove, and Halu sets the table, getting it ready for a meal of chicken, rice, dates, and brown tomatoes.
So it's this festival this month. It's good morning food.
That festival Halu's talking about is Ramadan, the holy month in the Muslim religion. Every night during the period from mid-July to mid-August, Halu and his family will gather here at sundown to end the day-long fast, read prayers, and celebrate. Occasionally, they'll have a guest or two, maybe a Muslim seasonal cannery worker, but most nights, it's just Halu, his wife, and their two young children. Ramadan is considered the most sacred month in the Muslim religion. The observance occurs during the ninth month of the religion's calendar, when Islam says God sent the Quran, the Muslim holy book, to the earth. It lasts for about 30 days, and it consists of increased prayer, more charity towards others, and most notably, fasting from sunrise to sundown. The practice is one of the most vital in the Muslim religion. It's one of the five pillars of Islam, and Halu says that for him, Ramadan is about patience, considering others, and focusing on improving himself, mentally and spiritually.
Because this is what Prophet said. I mean, it's about, you know, forgiveness, and it's good for the human being.
But when Halu was growing up, Ramadan was never this quiet and intimate. Halu was raised in Jordan, a largely Muslim country, and Ramadan wasn't just a month of prayer and fasting. It was a celebration.
We always really get excited when it get, you know, time for Ramadan, because time, you know, to see all family members, and it's time to see everybody asking God for forgiveness. And everybody is happy and everybody is satisfied spiritually, you know, everybody connected. So this is the idea, you know.
But those celebrations changed 3 years ago when Halu moved to Alaska. At first, it was for a cannery job during the summer. But then he met Angel, married her, and stayed. It's estimated that only about 3,000 Muslims live in Alaska, with most of them living in Anchorage. Halu and his wife believe they may be the only ones in Petersburg, at least year-round. And celebrating Ramadan that way, alone, is tough.
But you miss the family aspect. You miss the big festival.
Besides that, though, Halu says Ramadan in Alaska does have its advantages. You may not think so. Days in Petersburg are really long, around 16 or 17 hours. And that's a long time to go without food or water. But Halu says that those long hours are actually easier than when he dealt with in Jordan.
Because it's cool here, not hot. Mm-hmm. Very nice, you know, the summer here. You don't feel hot, so... Unlike Jordan, it's like 100 or 110. Yeah, so I think here it's easier, to be honest.
In Anchorage, those days can be even longer, 18 or even 19 hours. Those times are so extreme, in fact, that Muslims in Anchorage have to change their fasting schedule. Heather Barbour is with the Islamic Community Center in Anchorage, and she says 19 hours just isn't possible for most.
So that's a pretty long fast. So we discussed with some scholars who actually took the question down to Los Angeles to the North American Fiqh Council, which is basically a group of like 30 scholars who discuss issues like this. And they basically told us that because we do live so far north that we can follow the time of Mecca in Saudi Arabia.
That means stopping the fast while the sun's still out. But for many, it's the only way to get by in the land of the midnight sun. And with a relatively large Muslim population in Anchorage, it also means the community can gather, break fast together, and celebrate. Barbour says the community center gets around 100 people each night, crammed into a small rented space in a strip mall for a potluck celebration with an assortment of food and prayer. The community has started building a mosque too, and when Ramadan ceremonies move there, Barbour says the celebration will only get larger. In each case, rural and urban Alaska, Muslims have had to adapt and find new ways to pray that don't necessarily fit in with the rest of the world. In Petersburg, Halu says he's adjusted to the long hours and the separation. But in the next few years, he's hoping to get enough money to take his family to Jordan so they can see the Ramadan of his childhood, the traditional way. In Petersburg, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
A 16-year-old Kodiak boy who was shot by another teen on Sunday evening has died in Anchorage. Kodiak Police Department Lieutenant Ray Ellis said the boy died yesterday. Ellis declined to release the name of the victim, citing his age. He likewise couldn't release the name of the 15-year-old boy who was accused of the shooting. That boy was charged earlier this week with first-degree assault. He has been held at the Kodiak jail. In announcing the arrests, Police Chief T.C. Kamai said additional charges were possible. Ellis said the investigation into the shooting is ongoing and did not say if the accused shooter would face more serious charges in light of the victim's death. The shooting happened in a home where the victim was visiting at about 8:45 on Sunday evening. He was transported to Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center with a single shotgun wound and later medevaced to Anchorage. A search is underway for an 81-year-old man reported missing Tuesday. Alaska State Troopers and Anchorage Police are looking for Wallace Wilkinson Dunn, who was last seen at a soccer game on Thursday, July 11th. Dunn's family believes he left his Anchorage residence sometime the following day, headed for a cabin in Big Lake. Troopers found Dunn's truck, a gray 1998 Ford F-150, parked and locked several miles away from his cabin on Wednesday. For more than 2 months, a bulldozer has sat underwater in a small alpine lake near Talkeetna. Now, the state of Alaska says they have received a plan to recover the equipment. KTNA's Philip Manning has followed the story since May and has this report.
The submerged bulldozer broke through the ice on May 10th and sunk to the bottom of the lake, killing driver Donald Keel. Keel was traveling as part of a CAT train to Stepan Lake Lodge, where the heavy equipment was to be used to construct an airstrip supplying the preliminary research teams associated with the Susitna-Wetana Dam. Both the Talkeetna and Chase Community Councils have expressed concerns over a lack of information from the state of Alaska regarding the plan for removal of the 18-ton bulldozer. DNR says that they have now received the plan for the next steps in the recovery process. Cliff Larson, permitting manager for DNR, says that the contractor that operated the CAT train, Alaska Diversified Services, has contracted a dive team that will place float bags under the bulldozer so that it can be floated to a more stable position. A cable will then be rigged that will allow the complete removal of the dozer at a later date. The original DNR permit required the CAT train to stay on snow-covered terrain in order to protect the tundra underneath, and Larson says that will also be the case with the equipment used to extract the bulldozer. In addition to the recovery of the bulldozer itself, there is concern over the potential for hazardous materials leaking into the alpine lake.
As a rule of thumb, I would say that there's at least 100 gallons of petroleum or other potentially hazardous materials in there.
That's Stephen Russell, Environmental Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Russell says that while the amount of hazardous material makes this a serious incident, DEC views it as being far from the worst-case scenario.
If the hydraulic system, the driveline and transfer case and what have you that is containing the heavier oils is still intact, the acute local impact will be minor. If the diesel fuel is coming out and is coming out in small amounts, the chronic effect will be, I don't want to say minor, but it's certainly going to be less than if it was a catastrophic failure if the entire tank had ruptured at one time.
Russell says that it would be unsafe for divers to attempt to extract the diesel fuel and other liquids from the bulldozer while it still rests at an angle near a precipice under the lake. But that once it is stabilized and moved to shallower water, that efforts to prevent any further leakage might be possible. While the plan means there is progress on the recovery of the bulldozer that has been under the water for more than 2 months, both DEC and DNR say that the final recovery will have to wait until the ground freezes to prevent significant damage to the tundra. Stephen Russell says the trade-off of an earlier recovery would not be worth the environmental cost.
We're not quite at the point where we're willing to trade 18 miles of new CAT trail through the alpine environment to pull a dozer out now. The damage caused by that new CAT train would be significant.
Cliff Larson says that DNR is in continuous contact with Alaska Diversified Services and Stepan Lake Lodge, and that they are currently working out the details of the recovery plan before giving the final go-ahead. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. As an active senior, your independence is important to you. One of the ways for you to maintain your independence is to reduce your risk of falling. A fall risk assessment can be part of your initial or annual Medicare exam. They'll ask about your vision and review your medications for possible problems. Learn ways to improve balance, strengthen muscles, and reduce hazards at home. Contact your Medicare provider for an appointment. This message in good health is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A young Yupik man with roots in Kotlik on the lower Yukon has distinguished himself in the international competitive world of martial arts. KYUK's Sophie Ivan has the story.
The competition was televised on ESPN. Each event had 25 to 45 athletes from all over the world, like Japan, Korea, and China. Martinez won titles in traditional forms, continuous fighting, and clash sparring.
Ever since I was very young, I've always been interested in the martial arts. For example, watching the Ninja Turtles and watching Okamoto's his demonstrations across Anchorage.
And Michael was really impressed with that.
That's Martinez's mother, Mary.
And he had asked me to sign him up for Okamoto's, and martial arts training is not about kicking and punching, that it requires attention. So I waited till he was 7 to sign him up.
Martinez has been training in Anchorage since then, the past 6 years, to become the world's best. His sensei, Mr. Okamoto.
Represent the best things about what martial arts can do and hopefully what our school, Okamoto's Karate, does.
Okamoto says Martinez won with a 9.99 score out of 10 in the traditional forms contest. He describes what it means.
It encompasses blocks, punches, kicks, strikes. Normally, a student would demonstrate their skill in performing techniques as well as their balance, coordination, mental focus, emotional dexterity.
Martinez also brought the first place trophy home for continuous fighting and clash sparring, which he describes as engaging with three techniques involving stepping back and engaging again. He also placed third in the weapons division using a kama, which is a sickle-type axe.
I see myself improving and getting better, a new way of life, I'd say, a new understanding of a different type of activity.
Okamoto says his graduates have gone on to pursue acting and stunt work in Hollywood and doing bigger and better things.
I think some of the greatest stories I have are some of the students that never entered a ring, never went to a tournament, but used martial arts to help them do better in school, better in sports in general, and then as they became young adults, help them to make great choices as young adults going forward.
Michael plans to compete at the Junior Olympics in August. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Ivan.
Alaska could soon welcome back the era of the dirigible. Researchers argue that helium-powered cargo ships are cheaper and more flexible than conventional aircraft, and that could be a game-changer for rural Alaska communities that rely on regular shipments of fuel and supplies. A conference in Anchorage last week drew representatives from around the world to discuss the potential. APRN's Sarah Bernard reports.
A remote-controlled model airship is flying around the Wendy Williamson Auditorium at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And it's moving pretty fast for a blimp.
It's literally like a floating bag of helium.
German engineer Johannes Eising designed the model, and he says that's because it's actually a racing blimp.
Since about in 2004, I sat with friends in a bar, and we thought, hey, everyone had these great airship ideas. I said, hey, you know what, just build it, and we will have a race. And this was just thought as a joke, since airships are anything than fast, right? So we had this airship pylon race, and this was very good fun. It was in scope of a conference in Germany.
What everyone's talking about at this conference, the Cargo Airships for Northern Operations Workshop, feels like science fiction, or maybe a throwback to the 1930s. But it's not. It's real, it's now, and it's headed for Alaska. At least according to the workshop's technical chairman, Ron Hochstetler.
People think that the airships died in the smoldering ruins of the Hindenburg, but the new technologies of the airships, based on the advanced aerospace systems that were developed for airplanes and helicopters, are now transitioning into this new expanding, burgeoning cargo airship industry.
Hochstetler says that airships could transport far more cargo than airplanes to remote locations in the Arctic. And airships don't rely on expensive airport infrastructure.
If you can come up with a technology like the airship where you can put the vast majority of investment in the transportation system goes into the vehicle, not into the ground, now you've got a new game.
Airships are powered mostly by helium and don't move as quickly as airplanes, so they don't require as much fuel. And that makes more economic and environmental sense for remote locations. Hochstetler says Alaska is the best place to get this technology rolling.
You can go into some place like the tundra, and you can conceivably come into a place where no one's ever landed before and put something heavy down and fly away.
This is the third year that the Alaska Department of Transportation and NASA's Ames Research Center have partnered to put on the workshop. Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell helped develop the idea in 2010. He says he's ready to see airships take off in Alaska.
Everywhere in the state, we've got places where we'd like to see roads to resources, where you have villages that have to barge in fuel and supplies just once a year, where more immediate heavy lift transportation could not only be better for the environment in some cases, but also save costs for our villages.
Mira Kohler, president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, agrees. She says AVEC serves 55 villages scattered across about 500,000 square miles, and transportation is their biggest expense. Kohler says AVEC isn't necessarily about to jump on the airship bandwagon, but they're always open to new ideas.
If the technology matures to the point where we feel that that is really a viable way forward, we'll do whatever we can to help it become reality.
Aviation companies such as Lockheed Martin and Aero Vehicles Incorporated are starting to make concrete plans to build airships. If all goes smoothly, we could see a prototype conducting flight tests in a couple of years, and maybe starting commercial operations about 3 years after that. But what drives a lot of airship enthusiasts is just the wonder of the thing, how an enormous machine weighing tens or even hundreds of tons can float in the air. Ron Hochstetler says he first fell for the airship when he saw the Goodyear blimp on display decades ago.
Suddenly, I realized this silent ship is flying all the time. It belongs in the sky. It doesn't have to clamber into the air every time it wants to fly.
And if the attendees at this year's workshop have anything to say about it, that romantic notion will be the latest addition to Alaskan skies.
So don't be too surprised if you see an airship flying over your heads.
In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Bernard.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes and Sophie Evan in Bethel, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robbie Feinberg in Petersburg, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Sarah Bernard from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.